Group meeting, Friday, 12th March, 1982. You may remember this last time, since it was the 20th anniversary since our group started, we went through a short history of the groups as such, and I said a few words about the sort of spirit that animates us here. And then we mentioned certain points which I think are important points in connection with the living of the religious life. And I put it in the form of questions. With 20 years of work, the first thing was, are we quieter? You see. Now, this business of quietness and silence is one of the most important aspects of the religious life as such. Because as we live in the ordinary way, our life is a very noisy thing. There is psychical turmoil going on constantly. And physically, because of modern world conditions, there is so much noise all the time. So that man cannot live quietly and easily. And I thought it might be useful to consider a few things in connection with quietness. If we can maintain quietness in the ordinary sense of the word, in our daily physical life, and of course our psychical life, our thoughts and feelings and so on, then we become more and more sensitive to the profounder things of life, become more sensitive to reality as it is, in actual fact. Not only physical reality, or shall I put it this way, manifested reality, but the hidden, the unmanifested part of reality, which is all the time functioning there, you see, but to which mankind as yet is not sufficiently sensitive. We have our limitations as members of the human kingdom, and we can only go thus far and no further. But there are grades and grades of existence in terms of mind and consciousness which are quite beyond us, but which could come closer to us and help our life here. So this implies, first and foremost, an increased sensitivity. Now we must bear in mind that every step which we take forward, as we call it, any progress that we make, has its, to use an ordinary material word, has its gains. You gain something, true. But you also pay a price for it. If we became very sensitive to the state of the world, we find that it makes it more and more difficult for us to be intimately involved with the world, because it has a shattering influence upon the whole psychophysical organism. But this we must take in our stride. We must be well aware of this. There is no escaping the fact that as the human race develops and grows, it is bound to become more and more sensitive as a whole. And so this sensitivity is very important, because when this sensitivity grows, then there is clearer perception. We are better able to see the truth of things, of events, of people, conditions, and so on. We see them in a clearer light for what they actually are. Now, I mention this because our ordinary tendency is to wish that this, that, or the other were otherwise, that it were quite different from what it is. And we think that, we wish that, simply because it would suit us. And of course, that outlook is entirely self-centered and self-oriented. And with that sort of self-orientedness, there is no possibility of living our ordinary life in such a manner that our humanness can come to full fruition. It can't do it. Because, as I have mentioned over and over again, the word human literally means the blissful creator, the happy creator. And this is something which the world as a whole doesn't know. You'll never find this definition in a dictionary, for instance, even in a very clever etymological dictionary and so forth. But that's what the word human really means, the happy creator, the blissful creator, I would say, because the word bliss has a specific connotation in the religious context. Ordinarily, as ordinary everyday human beings, we know what pleasure means. It is sensational. We know what happiness means. Happiness is associated again with a pleasurable experience. It is also associated with qualities like contentment and general friendliness and so on. But we don't really know what bliss is. Most people think of bliss as the sort of extremity of pleasurable feeling or sensation. Now, this is hopelessly wrong, because the extremity of pleasure is really a destructive thing in so many ways, whereas bliss is very peaceful, it's very quiet. You see, this is where the element of quietness comes into the religious life. And it also means, therefore, together with a clearer perception, it means peace of mind. Now, peace of mind can never be there as long as the psyche is in a state of turmoil, if it is in an anxious state, if the psyche is longing for something special which it wants, you see, then one cannot have peace of mind, because that peace is beyond either gaining or not gaining what one desires. It has nothing to do with it, in fact. It is the person who becomes free of the bondage which personal desire, personal wishes and longings put upon one. It is that person who knows real peace. It is not the peace, it is not the sort of peace which you may impose on yourself by will. This is a very important point in the religious life, and it's a point which Krishnamurti has expounded, I think, rather more effectively than most of the teachers of the world, that if the will is brought into play here, you force yourself to be peaceful, then you are deluding yourself that this is the real peace of mind. You see, all the great spiritual values, all the what we may call the steps forward which we take through living the religious life in the real sense, are perfectly quiet. They don't cause any sense of I have advanced. In fact, they are like the work of the sculptor. He may take a block of metal or stone or whatever it is, and what he does is to chisel away the unwanted, the useless, and releases therefore the beauty that one may see in his sculpture. You see, it is a true ascesis, to use the Greek word. It's a true ascesis, and the work of the sculptor is the work, is an ascetic work, therefore. The removal and the letting go, of course, a sculptor actually uses force in order to remove what is not wanted. But we, as human beings, we cannot and should never attempt to use force on ourselves. We should let the unnecessary, the unwanted, fall away. This is very difficult, of course. It's not at all easy, but it can be done. And once one gets into it, so to say, then everything comes easily. I can compare it to a certain extent to the discipline of a pianist. If a person wants to become a really fine pianist, unless he is exceptionally gifted from birth onwards with the right sort of hands and fingers, he would find that the training of his hands and fingers is quite difficult and arduous. Because nature has not made our hands for the purpose of using the fingers on a keyboard like that. Hasn't made them like that. And therefore there is considerable difficulty involved in it. But there comes the point when, after a certain amount of discomfort, so to say, you suddenly sort of get it. And you say, ah, that's it, now I know what to do. You have become really conscious of the art of using your fingers in such a manner and your hands in such a manner that your practice, your scales and studies and so forth, is no longer hurtful. It just happens. And the difficulties and the obstructions to playing perfectly, you will notice, will just naturally fall away. You don't have to use force any longer. It just happens naturally. Now, all growth, to be healthy growth, must be of that sort. It must be natural. It has to be spontaneous. We know how person is born, is baby, and as he grows up, no force can be exerted upon him to make him grow in this, that, or the other way. Whenever force is used to produce a particular result, because it's considered good or beautiful, then you only get deformity. One can recall the Chinese custom of binding the feet of girls because it was considered beautiful to have very, very small feet. But of course it produced only unpleasant results, and that's no use. So you see, this psychical turmoil can quieten down. And with the sort of development in quietness as such, as a whole, with the greater sensitivity, the clearer perception, and the peace of mind which gets associated with it, it can ultimately lead to the true silence. Now, this silence is a very, very important thing altogether. It starts with silence where the tongue is concerned. We have to learn to hold our tongue. You look at the world as it is. You look even at cultural and cultured groups and serious people who are interested in the deep things and realizing the deep things. When they meet together, there's a tremendous clatter. All the time there is a tremendous clatter. And it's useless stuff. Most of it is useless stuff. One word in 100 may be a valuable word in that particular situation, whatever it may be. Because, you know, when people get talking, especially when we are very young, we talk at a tremendous speed and we all talk together simultaneously. And we never listen to the other person. Rarely listen to the other person. And all the time that the other person is talking, one's own brain is talking back, agreeing, disagreeing, contradicting, criticizing, approving, disapproving, and so on. You see? So this state of turmoil and conflict goes on all the time. So the first thing to do is to learn to be quiet where conversation is concerned. I believe there is a delightful story of Tennyson and Carlyle. Is it? I think it was those two people. One of them lived in one of those squares by Belgrave Road, and the other. Both of them, of course, were famous men, and one of them came visiting. And they sat silently for, some 2 or 3 hours. And then, let us say it was Tennyson who got up and said, thanks you so much for a delightful conversation in the evening, and said goodbye. And the other person agreed. But now you see, this is a very significant thing. To converse means one person says something, the other person listens carefully, considers it to the best of his ability, and makes a due response. Now, we rarely come across that sort of thing in life. This with ordinary, audible conversation. But it is possible for two people who are close to each other in spirit to converse without saying a word. It's extraordinary how it happens. There is a silent interplay between the brains of the psyches of the two people concerned. They can converse without saying a word. Now, where the religious life is concerned, you know how in ancient Greece, in the school of Pythagoras, the neophytes were called akoustikoi. They were listeners. They had to be completely silent, except when the situation demanded that they should say yes or no or thank you or whatever it was. But they were to be completely silent and listen to the elders speaking. So they were akoustikoi. Now we have to start by being akoustikoi. And we have to listen not only to people around us, but we have to listen to everything around us. And you will notice that if you were to just sit quietly and sit very attentively, intently and attentively, you will become aware of a process of listening which is something quite new and extraordinary. You will become aware. Your sensitivity in terms of the use of your ears, your listening faculty, is becoming deeper and deeper. Now it is the same with looking. That sensitivity becomes deeper and deeper. And you won't see anything with your eyes, which you don't see in the ordinary way, or hear with your ears, which you don't hear as sound. But this subtle, this sensitivity, as it deepens, becomes something quite indescribable. And it is this sort of sensitivity which I think the old Indians referred to when they talked of the subtle senses. Particularly in the Sankhya philosophy, they said that the ordinary physical senses which we have a corresponding subtle sense at play. But as and when this subtle sense works, you will find that inspiration will come to you much more easily. Especially if you have any artistic or similar gift to start with, it will emerge from inside, just like that, you see. Now, this silence, it culminates in the complete quietening, the utter stillness of thought and of speech. Put it in other terms, all conceptualizing and verbalizing activity ceases. That doesn't mean that you've lost the ability to conceptualize or to speak. Far from it. You will find yourself capable of producing far profounder concepts. But the actual process in the brain will come to rest. It'll come to rest. Now, what is the significance of this? Let us look at the significance of language, words which we use. The important words are either nouns or verbs, and then adjectives and adverbs only sort of alter the intensity or degree or give color to it and so forth. Nouns stand for objects, for people, for things. And the verbs are action words. The relationship in terms of action between the subject and the object. You see? So you have your nouns at either end and you have the verb in the middle. But now look at your nouns and look at your verbs afterwards. Look at nouns first. They all stand for people or objects, situations, events, conditions and so on, don't they? All right. But all these belong to the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. Is there any noun which stands for anything outside the finite and the mortal? Yes, there are nouns, but you'll notice all those nouns are nouns which negate the finite and the mortal. We, we have words like infinity, immortality, eternity. But they are words which negate the finite and the mortal. We haven't any nouns which are positive expressions of these negating nouns. You see? We can have a noun like absolute, we can have a noun like God or Atma. They are nouns, you see, which are positive, but if you look deeply into them, you'll find the implication is the negating of the absolute negates the relative. You see? And Atma negates the idea, the idea of the personal separate entity in the universe. It denies the non-relationship between the self and the totality of the not-self. Atma includes everything. All right? So you see, these nouns are nouns, we have just a few such words in any language. They negate the finite and the mortal and the temporal. In other words, they negate all that belongs to the realm of suffering, of non-fruition, of conflict, of misery, and all the rest of it. You see? So now, in the ordinary way, when we say we are thinking or trying to meditate, what do we do? You will notice that we are going through a verbal ritual. I mean, take any of the ordinary well-known meditations, whether they are the meditations as taught in the theistic religions or in the non-theistic religions, you see. You will find that when the teacher, so-called, teaches you to meditate, what is he doing? He is telling you to think like this, you see, to make the picture of the master in your mind, to visualize this, and so on and so on. You see? But all this is only in the realm of the finite and the mortal. You can't use the finite and the mortal to obtain release into the infinite and immortal. Can't do it. This is where all the laid down systems make their mistake. But people don't see that. They are always looking for the great meditation master or the Holy One who is going to teach me how to live in order that I may enter heaven or nirvana or some such thing. The whole thing is self-oriented, in order that I may gain the infinite. Can a cup contain the oceans of the world? The earth contains the ocean. The whole planet contains the oceans of the world. But a cup can't contain the oceans of the world. You see? So now, we begin to see the importance of silence in the real sense. So our ordinary thinking is really, our ordinary thinking is simply inaudible chatter. And our ordinary conversation is audible chatter. That's the only difference. You see? So now, the entry into the real silence means that this chatter in the brain, which goes on constantly, non-stop, will stop. You see, it settles down by itself. You can produce a silent state by hitting somebody hard enough on the head, render him unconscious. But that is no progress. That is a regress, in fact. You see? And that's no use. You have to practice ordinary quietness first, and the organism will develop the faculty of allowing turmoil, physical and psychical, to become still, to settle down. It will be like something like the weather. You have a strong gale blowing or something. After a time, there is quiet again, peace. You see? It's something like that. Now, consider in what state of, in what manner are we conscious in our ordinary everyday life in the world? We are conscious in the mode of finitude and of mortality. Everything starts, proceeds, finishes. You see? And we associate our what we call ourself with everything as it emerges, proceeds, and perishes. This is the only real meaning to rebirth and reincarnation, because there is this postulated I am I, which is constantly associated in our conscious in our process of conscious living with every single event and whatever is happening, whatever we are thinking, and so on and so on. You see, so our mode of awareness is the mode of awareness of that realm over which death is lord. You get it? Now, as and when all the nouns and verbs, adjectives and everything become completely quiescent, completely quiet, then in what manner are you conscious? You are conscious in the manner which is non-finite, and therefore infinite, which is non-temporal, therefore timeless, and more than timeless, in the supreme states it is eternal, and mortality has come to an end, for the very simple reason that the consciousness which is able to be completely attentive to the mortal process is able to transcend the limitation of beginning, which means birth, and the finishing, which means death. So you are conscious, actually conscious, in the mode of immortality. And that is the only immortality that there is for human beings. There is no other immortality, and certainly not in mythical heavens or nirvanas or some such thing. You ask a Buddhist to try and present to you, or a Hindu, what nirvana means to him, and you examine that very carefully, and you will find that it means that all that he presents is something finite and mortal. It isn't nirvana. It isn't the kingdom of heaven. So the silence implies, the realization of the silence implies that your mode of consciousness, your mode of awareness of the world in which we live all the time, you see, all through time, has been transformed into the mode of awareness of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. This is our divine potentiality within us. The theistic religions have summed up these things in the word God, or Godhead. Gottheit, as used by Eckhart, is really far sounder than merely using Gott, you see. And I never tire of quoting Eckhart saying, man verily is God. God verily is man. But Gottheit subsumes both Gott and man. You find in Genesis, and Elohim said, I don't like the translation said. I would far prefer to put it this way. And Elohim minded. This is the creative energy. Mind. And Elohim minded, let us make man in our own living likeness. I don't like the word image. Now just consider this. How does the ultimate creative energy mind anything? It doesn't mind it or think it in the way we think. Our thinking is just so many words, and our thinking is impotent to create. It can't create. But if we undergo this process, if we can really get completely purified so that the psychophysical organism is no longer in turmoil but is in a state of the real silence, then the noise of the world is like heaven's own music. You see? Everything is silent. Hence, one is actually in a completely blissful, silent state, whether one is in the presence of terrible noise and turmoil, or whether one is in a quiet atmosphere, as we commonly call it. So this is the important thing to realize. This cessation not meaning the annihilation or destruction, but the quietening down of speech and ordinary thinking. The conceptualizing and verbalizing activity has completely come to rest. And when it has completely come to rest like that, the brain, which is the repository of all our ordinary psychical activity, you see, undergoes a transformation. The result is that the organism becomes an apparatus. I think that's a good word to use in this context. It becomes an apparatus to enable the power of transcendence, the power of this primordial creative energy, to function freely through you. You see, the primordial creative energy and absolute consciousness, when first they sort of course this language is not good, but then language is so difficult that I can't make it put it in better terms. When it first started, the energy started differentiating and consciousness started proliferating, the two intertwined together and produced grades of being, which I have always called awareness being, you see. And these grades exist at all levels, and therefore there are those levels which are on a cosmic scale, and other levels which we ordinarily know come right down to material manifestation, you see. So, we as a the psychophysical organism called a human being, as a material manifestation, can be the apparatus, can become the apparatus through which the transcendent functions. That this transcendent energy, this divine energy, flows freely into our very psychophysical being and flows out without let or hindrance. This is one of the reasons why the holy ones are reputed to be in constant samadhi, meditation as they call it. Meditation in this true sense, the true meditation has no relationship with what the world calls meditating. What did Hitler meditate? What did Torquemada meditate? What did Napoleon meditate? You see? It is like that. And this state of meditation means that you have at last so cleansed yourself that transcendence manifests itself freely and perfectly through you, the apparatus, as the perfected man. This is one of the purposes of our existence. It's only one of the purposes. There are other purposes too, but we need not go into them at the moment, you see. If we really see that, even with our brains, poor as they are still, you see, if we can really grasp that idea, then all self-centeredness vanishes. Conceit and false self-esteem vanishes, you see. And our life's activity no longer is self-oriented, drawing the world to ourself for our gain, our pleasure, to satisfy our power, lust, and all the rest of it. But we are like the Holy Grail, you see, the cup which has no bottom to it, and therefore through it the waters of eternal life can flow freely and benefit mankind all the time. But the brain as such won't know it, because knowing by the brain means knowing in terms of concepts and words, which are the finite thing. But it will be like that. And the person, the perfected Holy One, doesn't know he's the perfected Holy One in our ordinary sense. You see? I sometimes wonder when people like Beethoven or Shakespeare or Kalidas or Homer wrote or composed or whatever they did, whether they knew that they were that, or were they just the unself-conscious instrument of divinity itself. So you see, that is why I inquired last time, are we, through our 20 years of work, a little bit quieter? You see the tremendous significance of this. Then there is the peace of God which passeth understanding. It is there. It is not ours. It belongs to transcendence, but transcendence uses us to manifest transcendence.